This is HPR episode 2222 entitled, Fostum 2017K, Level 1, Rupert. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 90 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Ken interviews the projects in Rupert of the VK building Level 1.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, I'm at the KDE booth and I'm talking to Jonathan Revell.
Good afternoon.
How are you today?
We're doing great today. We've had a lot of business. It's been pretty packed. We've been selling stuff, we've been demonstrating stuff. We've had people, first timers, going, what's this open source stuff? And people going, I want to code and I've got this bug and tell me how to fix it. So the usual full range of people that you get at FOSDEM is great.
Last year we broke the cracking news about KDE Neon and I was so annoyed that most people didn't listen to the interview because for some reason there was a shitstorm after you launched.
Well, I try and stay out of it because one of the ideas of KDE Neon is we can, to coin a phrase, take back control and we're not reliant on some third party to ship our software. So now KDE is building all the KDE software directly within our Neon continuous integration system, directly from Git or directly from releases, depending if you want a stable or developer edition. And it's the easiest way to run our software. So we're no longer dependent on third parties. We can do our own thing and people can get it directly the minute that we release it.
Is it still reliant on Kubuntu underneath or is there a day when we can run whatever underlying OS?
We use the Ubuntu long-term support as a stable base and we'll upgrade to the next long-term support. But it doesn't use any other part of the Ubuntu setup. But obviously we build all our own packages, but what we're looking at, one of the things we're demonstrating here is new package formats that are cross-distro. So this game that we see here, it looks like just any other application, but it's running within a Snappy package. So that's a containerized package format, and it's built directly from the same KDE Neon continuous integration stuff, so available directly as soon as it's released, but it will run on any Linux distro, and it involves just installing Snappy, and then you can snap install, and we've got integration with our Plasma Discover package manager or whatever package manager your distro uses.
And how does that handle all the dependencies? Or are you deliberately cheating by picking a small library that doesn't need a lot of dependencies?
It includes, you can layer the different containers, and so there will be a base system layer, and there'll be a KDE layer that includes the Qt and KDE libraries, and then there'll be the application layer. So those parts will be updated as new versions come, but it will all be included when you just download it. It will be transparent to the user, and you're just downloading one application and running the application, and it will automatically get everything that you need with it.
Okay. So I can still take applications that are Snappy applications and run them on Fedora, for example?
And you can run it on any Linux distro, you can run it on Fedora. Now, Fedora have a competing format called Flatpak, so we're also investigating that because we have no preferences ourselves. We just want to work with whatever the users, what works best for the users. So we also have people working on KDE integration with Flatpak, and so you can download KDE libraries and applications with Flatpak, whatever works, and we'll see what wins out in the end.
How did KDE Neon as a project work out? It's been a year down the line. How are things going?
I'm really pleased with how it's been. It seems to have a lot of mindshare with what our target audience is, which is KDE enthusiasts and people who have heard about this KDE stuff and want to try it out. So if you look on the social media channels, it's a real pleasure to run the KDE Neon Twitter account. Every Monday I wake up, look at the Twitter account, and somebody's gone, oh, I just installed KDE Neon. It's great. I can finally get the latest stuff. So it's really nice to get that kind of feedback of people directly on, say, Reddit. You can look at the KDE forum on Reddit, and typically they show, what, 30 stories, and like 10 of those will be about KDE Neon. So we seem to have a lot of mindshare within the KDE crowd, which is what we want, but also within the Linux forum on Reddit, for example. There's a lot of KDE Neon coverage on there because we do new features, new addition add-ons every day. So we're great for generating news on that, and the users seem to love that with giving us their feedback.
So what's the plan for the coming year? What's KDE Neon going to be doing? Me specifically.
I will be fighting for freedom and against tyranny, as always. I will be replacing the installer. So the installer currently uses the same one as Kubuntu, which I wrote a decade ago, and it's not well maintained. We're replacing that with one called Calamaris, which is a cross-distro installer that works on quite a number of different distributions. But it misses some features, so I'll be adding in those features or working out how to replace that. We'll be working more on the containerized format, so we'll hopefully be going public with the Snappy formats or the Flatpak formats, so those are instantly available. But most exciting, we're shipping for the first time. You can buy a KDE Slimbook, a laptop shipping with KDE software, KDE branded, directly. You can make sure that it's tested. Our software is tested with the hardware, so you know it's all going to work for you. And it comes with KDE Neon, of course, so it'll come with the latest KDE software. And you can buy that now to ship in March. And it's got a nice KDE logo on the back as well.
Wow, how much is that?
So you can customize it, different options. Cheapest one, I think, is €729. And if you add in more faster processor, memory, hard disk, it goes up to €1239.
And what sort of hardware is it running?
It's called a Slimbook. It's designed to look quite a lot like a MacBook. It's very light. It's very very slim.
It is very sexy looking.
It looks very slick, and it's a 13.3-inch screen, and it's pleasingly fast as a processor. A solid state disk. So yeah, I don't use magnetic disks anymore. They're just painful. Solid state disk, the way to go. And you can buy it with whatever keyboard you're most comfortable with.
And what motivated you to do that? Where did that come from?
Well, that's what I've been trying to do for the last 15 years, right, is make software and get it into the hands of users.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of being too broad and saying we're going to take over the world, and that didn't happen, but at least we can take over the enthusiasts, the geek market, the people who want to free themselves of Windows, who have heard of our great community and want to be part of it. But we've never been able to complete the full circle, so we've always been reliant on some third-party distributions to package our software, and that takes time, and then people to reinstall stuff. So with the whole Neon project, we want to be able to get it into the hands of users as fast as we can, and as conveniently as we can. So there's the ultimate convenience.
Where can I buy this?
Where can you buy it? KDE.slimbook.es, the Spanish website, or directly from the KDE website. The news stories will give you the links to it. And as I say, you can buy now and it will ship next month. And yeah, they're really slick. I'm really happy with them.
Cool. Well done. Okay, thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you for interviewing me.
I'm here at the GNOME booth, and I'm talking to
Bastian Ilso.
Hi, and what is GNOME?
GNOME is a desktop environment, a free desktop environment, available for anyone to use. We are aiming to be an elegant and going for a simple user experience, with focus on designing the next generation of desktops.
And what distributions ship GNOME as a default desktop now?
There's a few. There's, for example, Ubuntu GNOME. There's Fedora.
What has been happening in the GNOME community in the last year? Any major releases?
Yes, so within the last year we've had the GNOME 3.22 release and the GNOME 3.20 release. This year has been filled with things like Let me think. So it would be much easier if I could show you the release videos. That's the ones that I make actually for the GNOME projects. We have a big ecosystem of applications that get updates throughout this year. I know that Nautilus, for example, the file manager, one of the GNOME's main file manager, has gotten search filters. We have GNOME Builder, which is a fairly new project, an IDE, which attempts to bridge the gap of creating an easy platform for the future GNOME development, so you can develop on any distribution the GNOME apps.
What sort of language is GNOME written in?
GNOME is written in. So GNOME is this kind of umbrella thing. We have a lot of libraries. They are written mostly in C. Then we have the apps. They are written in more high-level programming languages such as Python, JavaScript. Some are written in Vala. And there's also bindings for C#. So lots of different languages there. And this is possible due to introspection, which makes it possible to use the C libraries that we have in many of the other high-level languages to make it easier for front-end developers to use the newest programming languages to write GNOME applications.
There's quite a big community, and you have lots of events going on. What new events are coming up this year?
So there's Quatic in the summer. We also have. We have the big Quatic conference, which is the annual GNOME conference, and that one is happening in July. Then we have a GDK Hackfest happening in 1 month, so that's also going to be really exciting. GDK is moving onwards towards GDK 4, with GDK 3.22 just released last year. I bet the GDK Hackfest is going to be revolving a lot around what's going to happen next.
The cool new stuff's coming in.
Exactly.
So, what are you doing here on the booth?
Here in the booth, we're selling merchandise. I brought a lot of GNOME socks, and we also have GNOME t-shirts with some cool new GNOME motifs. We have hoodies, we have flyers, both flyers explaining and you know, we're trying to engage with people, asking them if they would be interested in getting involved, but also hearing feedback from all the users. There's so many people here at Fostum.
So what type of people come past the booths? People who use GNOME all the time and just want a memorabilia, or just new users?
Yeah, we have a lot of users who are long-time GNOME users or who are using GNOME every day, and they come here and they say, "Oh, thank you so much for being part of this project." And some of them are also interested in, you know, getting involved. Like, how can I develop apps in this GNOME ecosystem and so forth. So.
Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
No problem.
Hi, I'm at the LibreOffice booth, and I'm talking to
Italo Vignoli.
Hi, we spoke last year. Can you tell us briefly what LibreOffice is about?
LibreOffice is a free office suite. It's based on the old OpenOffice code we forked in 2010, so 7 years ago. It's now we have just released the 5.3 is a major release with several new features, interesting ones. We have introduced we have improved the user interface to a point that is now really different from the past, and visibly different from the past. And we have released for the first time the source code of the online office suite. We have to be very clear in this point specific. We are not providing the infrastructure as Google Docs and Office Microsoft Office 365. This is not what the Document Foundation is for. So we provide the source code. People can integrate LibreOffice Online, of course, with the cloud.
Yep.
And with a secure access, so SSH or something that provides secure sign-on. It is full feature. The engine is the same. So of course, this is the first. We will see what happens with the developments. There are already integration with OwnCloud, NextCloud, PDO, and C-File.
Yeah.
Which and also Colab as some kind of integration.
Yeah.
Of course, we expect the other project to integrate it. And for sure, what we think it would be interesting is seeing some internet service provider integrating that to provide a real alternative to the to Google Docs and Office 365. And enterprises deploying that on the private cloud.
Absolutely, absolutely. Have there been any, you also work with the Open Document Foundation.
Sure.
Is there any improvement, any news in the last year?
I mean, the improvement to the Open Document are continuous. We work on a regular basis. We have at least a couple of meeting every year, but the technical committee meets every week, so the process, as it should be for every standard, is slow, but is continuous. Of course, the situation in the marketplace is different because the is not ODF is not very well.
No worries. We're well used to interruptions here. It's live from the.
ODF is not as known as other formats,
yep.
And although it's a real standard, many people think that the Microsoft Office format is standard, which is absolutely not true.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeing some improvement in terms of adoptions.
Yep.
The UK government has adopted it. Of course, the process of from the law that adopts to the real adoption, the process is slow.
Yeah.
There are behind that there are 20 years of
it takes time. It takes
complete time. Ignorance on formats, but now Sweden, France, Taiwan, and the Netherlands are on the same path. Although each government is adopting it in a different way, as it normal. I mean, yes. The law is different, but. We see an uptake in terms of awareness of the importance of standards.
Absolutely.
In some countries where there is not a law, we see enterprises, we see people learning about the advantages of a standard. For instance, in Italy, Ministry of Defense has migrated to LibreOffice. At first, they intended to migrate to keep the old format, so the Microsoft format. We told them let just make a try, and after 6 months they decided to go to the ODF, and they said there's no real comparison. I mean, the consistency of ODF documents is so high that no other format gives the same
yeah.
And you save a large amount of money because of the hidden cost of interoperability. So you open the document, and the document is there. The only thing that might happen is that you don't have the font installed. Yeah. But if the font is not installed either, you find a similar one, but you don't lose the contents.
Yeah.
So we have to learn to use standard or to standardize on fonts a little bit, but I think that this is a minor issue in comparison.
Especially now that there are free and open fonts that are
exactly.
good looking available.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just a matter of time before they're deployed and on systems and that we can rely on having them in our documents.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So what's is there any new events coming up this year that people can go and attend? Or
we have we try to be at the most important events with either with a speech or with a booth. most open source event, of course. We will have the LibreOffice conference is going to be at the end of September in Rome.
Yeah.
And we will try to be at conferences in the United States, at OSCON, we will try to have a booth there, and at some of the Linux conference around Europe and in the other environments, the other countries.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for the interview and look forward to talking to you later. Hi everybody, I'm at the Copano booth and I'm talking to?
I'm Michael Cromer.
And how do I pronounce that project?
Copano.
That's better. So what is Copano?
Copano is a full groupware plus stack. What that means is that we have the classical groupware pattern, mail, calendar, tasks, notes, everything that you can expect from a traditional groupware provider. But we do more than that, actually. We do have a files integration. We have a complete web meeting solution, WebRTC based. We do have a complete active sync implementation called Zpush, which allows you to synchronize all your information to your mobiles, whether it is iOS, Android, Windows Mobile. Actually, also you can use active sync implementation for Microsoft Outlook. We also provide a so-called Copano Outlook extension, which gives you the ability to come over the lack of the active sync implementation within Outlook itself, providing extra features and everything. And we are entirely focused on the collaboration space and professional communication space. What that means is we have one interface, and this one interface is web app, and the same interface you can experience in desk app, which is desktop client that runs on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS. And all the features that I just mentioned are all combined in that interface. It's an easy-to-use interface. It is well designed. At least that's what our customers tell us and community users. We do have a quite large stack because it is a very complicated space. Of course, you can also interface us via IMAP, but preferably there are other better ways to integrate with it. It's communication everywhere and integrating the most modern and most native approach with other solutions, as you can imagine.
And it's 100% open source, is that correct?
It is 100% open source, indeed, yes.
So, is it open core?
No, it is not open core. Copano is, we do it by subscription-based model. So what we do is we have a very extensive QA. So ranging from standard unit tests, you can imagine, down to automation tests, installation tests, compatibility tests. So our QA is very strong in that. And next to that, we provide like the supported builds is one thing, and support. So with the subscription, you get support for your environment. You don't have to take support, of course. But of course, especially when it comes to communication, people are quite inclined, because when they're down, it's a bad situation for them. And that's what the support is all about.
So this makes it completely transparent. If somebody's got an iPhone, Android app, they can just install interface with this.
The good thing about our implementation is we are doing native active sync with Zpush. It's the leading active sync implementation in the world. And the good thing about active sync is it's natively available in all the major platforms, including even BlackBerry 10, for example. So you don't require the installation of an app. You just need to set up, basically like you would set up a Microsoft Exchange server. So you set up the server, the username, the password. We even have auto-discover. So it's even as enough just to add your email address when auto-discover has set up. And then you can choose whatever app you want to use with your email. So there are many email apps that you can buy for money or just free. Just go to the app store of your native environment and just choose the mail application that you would like to use. Because the ActiveSync data is natively stored in the device. And therefore you can interact with it, you can share it, you can move it around, you can group by threads, everything that you can do with the app of your choice.
Excellent. And you release it under what license?
It is AGPL3.
So hardcore open source.
Hardcore open source.
Excellent. And are you finding that you're able to make a business, commercial business out of it?
So we as Copano, we're not here since just yesterday. Copano, as it exists now, exists since the 1st of April last year. But in fact, we are coming from Serafa. So Serafa, most people know that Serafa was an open core company. And as this company was like had also closed source components, we decided as Copano one step forward, and we used that to re-implement many things. So for instance, our old MAPI client had certain limitations, but they were not inclined by us, they were inclined by Microsoft. Therefore now our complete new approach with a complete redevelopment of many components that we had, like backup for instance, like the Outlook extension, these components, these have been rewritten entirely from scratch, and we decided to go directly 100% open source, as you can imagine. So we don't see a necessity nowadays anymore to keep this special parts closed source and the rest open source. That just doesn't make any sense for us anymore.
Cool. And it's available Debian, OpenSUSE, Ubuntu, Red Hat?
It is available for Debian, OpenSUSE, Ubuntu, Red Hat, SUSE Linux Enterprise Server, CentOS. I'm missing certainly some.
So it's an apt-get install away, basically.
Apt-get install, zipper in, yum install, whatever you like. So
will it run on a Raspberry Pi?
Yes. Yes. At the moment, unfortunately, you still have to compile it yourself, but the source is available. Just go for it. The only thing which is, we're in the process of also providing like ARM builds. We actually do for OpenSUSE, by the way, but for Debian, actually not yet. So this is an ongoing development. We're doing that together with the community. Also, one great thing, maybe a side note, is that we just recently, like last week, got included in OpenSUSE Factory, which means that we're going upstream or downstream with OpenSUSE. And the same process is ongoing with Debian at the moment.
Takes a lot.
And I don't know if we're going to make it with Debian 9. I'm not sure of the status exactly there, but it's in progress. So thanks to the community.
Good. A lot of work going on. So what's coming up next year?
Quite a lot. Since I already mentioned we're a MAPI groupware, and we're quite proud of that. Still, MAPI has some downsides in some areas. But as I just mentioned, we do this now for 10 years, so we really know what we're talking about. And what we're focusing on this year is make things more performant. That means that, for instance, we're implementing a so-called token-based authentication that will allow the round-trip times to lower round-trip times, basically, that it does not take like a half a second to open up a mail, but instead like a tenth of a second. And so we're doing a lot there. Next thing what we're up to is we're starting the implementation of a REST interface where others can interoperate better with us, basically. Next to that, we're making quite large steps in web app. So web app is getting quite some personal organization optimization. What that means is categories that you can. I mean, we already have the ability to create our own categories. For instance, when you want to group your information, but we will make it even easier. Like not only just having a mailbox, but having more of a information management on top of your mailbox. That you only have like the high priority issues to you, that you really get like a more focused on what is important to you and whatnot.
Great stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. You too.
Hi everybody. I'm at the Citi CRM booth, and I'm talking to.
I'm Alan Bembassett, and I'm a CVCRM consultant.
And what is CVCRM?
CVCRM is an open source CRM database that allows you to manage your contacts. And your contacts can be individuals, households, or organizations. And it has out-of-the-box a lot of functionality for especially civic organizations for the nonprofit sector, like membership management, bulk mailings, contributions, you can group your contacts, etc., according a lot of criteria.
So CRM is customer relationship management, and CIVI will be for civic institutions.
Organizations.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, great name, isn't it?
So where are you based? Is it an organization? What's the background?
The organization was founded about 12 years ago in the United States. And it's a non-profit organization. There are currently three developers that are funded to develop CVCRM, but they are supported by a lot of contributors from all over the world.
And what's it written in and how does it run? What language is it written in and what is it?
CVCRM is developed in PHP and it's based on MySQL database.
I can run MirandaDB, I presume. I can run it on MirandaDB.
Yeah. And it's the particularity is that it's an extension of your CMS. And the CMS that are supported are Drupal, WordPress, or Joomla.
Okay. So it acts as a plugin for those?
It's actually a plugin, but it's a full-fledged CRM system. So when you click on the CVCRM menu item, you enter the CVCRM world where you have all your contact management and reporting functionality.
Fantastic. What sort of license is it released under?
It's AGPL version 3, so it's fully free to use, to download, to customize. You can hack the code if you want, create extensions, etc.
And do you have anything planned for the coming year?
The plan is to have more users of CVCRM because we have now more than 10,000 users, but you know, it would be great to have much more users from all over the world. Now, about half of the users are based in the United States and the other half in the rest of the world, like UK, Belgium, the Netherlands, New Zealand.
So would it be, say I've got my own WordPress blog and I'm maintaining the HBR list, would that be something that I would use for a small use case like that, a few hundred people?
Yeah, a few hundred people is no problem. Then you can use the out-of-the-box functionality. Yeah. If you have the need to send them regularly an email, for instance, or do some marketing stuff, then it's great. If you need some segmentation of your contacts, you can use it either. If from time to time you organize an event, it's great to register your participants. Yeah.
That might be useful for a lot of projects here. So thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi everybody, I'm at the Taylor booth and I'm talking to
Christian Grothoff.
And what is Taylor?
Taylor is a new electronic payment system which is part of the GNU project, which allows you to pay anonymously, easily, with full privacy, very efficiently. However, whenever you receive money, the state can see what you're receiving, how much you're receiving, but not from whom. So the state can levy taxes on you, like income tax or sales tax, and hopefully pay for things like this nice university we have here with that money.
Absolutely. But this is a very, very difficult project issue to solve. I remember discussing this not 2 years ago with RMS. How have you come up with a solution for this?
Well, 2 years ago, we already were talking with RMS as well about this, because we had the crypto finally worked out that we wanted. The crypto is based on, to some extent, on old cryptography from David Chaum from the 90s, using basically blind signatures, so it allows you to withdraw digital tokens that you can then spend without being correlated back to when you withdrew them. But we had to solve problems like how to give change, and how to integrate this really nicely with browsers and the modern web infrastructure and the restrictions that it imposes on you in terms of security. So it's been 2 years of engineering by now, and we have a demonstration up. If you go to demo.taylor.net with any of the modern free browsers, you should be able to download an extension and try it out yourself. Make yourself a bank account at our fake bank and go spend fake money to buy Richard's articles on our webpage.
Awesome. Tell me, is it... This sort of stuff is complex, and anywhere in the chain that there's a vulnerability in the chain, my bank account is suddenly empty. How do I build up trust? How do I know I can trust you?
Well, it's of course free software, so we have an open standard, papers on the protocol, you can read the documentation, you can read the specification, you can read the code. Many of you may be able to do this, others may not be able to do this. We of course had experts review it, including a bunch of cryptography professors, a bunch of networking professors. I myself have been publishing in the area for over 15 years, so I have hopefully built up some reputation, some trust with some of you. You may know I'm also the maintainer of GNUnet, and some of the code has been based on stuff that we worked in on GNUnet for 15 years now. And of course, ultimately, once we get closer to production, we will plan to find investors to pay for external security audits so that more than just our core team has looked over the code. I hope the code is extremely clean and well documented, which we're still trying to, of course, improve that. And in the end, the system does depend on having a banking license and having a regulator that assures you that your money is safe, just like your money is safe when you go to your bank these days. And so most people in the end will probably trust the government to regulate the banks. And if the government fails on that, well, we are in trouble in many other fronts, not just this particular payment system.
And you are now, how easy would this be for a bank professional to go, okay, I'm going to switch from this thing or I'm going to implement Taylor. Are we there yet? Are we at a point where you can deploy?
For what kind of professional?
A financial professional, somebody who does this for a living. Say my local bank or my local co-op wants to implement Taylor payment system.
Well, it turns out we talked to some banks and they outsource all of the development anyway, so they won't do this. And so we had a bank that effectively asked their outsourced software house to give them a cost estimate for how much it would take to build it or integrate it. That would of course depend on your bank, what kind of infrastructure you have in place. I can't easily say this, but we have a very simple adapter where effectively you have to, as for the exchange provider, give us the list of incoming wire transfers and the ability to make outgoing wire transfers, and to add 11 lines of HTML to your customer portal for the withdrawal integration. Now, sometimes that can be tricky because of special constraints the bank have internally, but the effort itself is not actually all that big. It's pretty compatible with existing things. And what surprised me is that some of the banks have immediately said, yeah, this is totally okay with regulation. There should not be problems there. So we've talked to several experts that have all confirmed that we are at least compliant. So I think it's really just a question of convincing a sufficient number of banks to make the investment, which of course, you know, maybe a couple of 10,000 euros to add the protocol to their existing infrastructure and run the services, and then hopefully we'll be able to offer it for you to do web payments.
How is the authentication going to be done? Username and password or an external device?
Okay, there are two kinds of authentication. There's the authentication you do when you withdraw money from your bank account. There you use what you use today, your probably account number, password, SMS to your mobile phone, whatever your bank, you do this today to authenticate you when you do online banking. It's exactly what you will continue to use to tell your bank that you want to withdraw money into your wallet. And the nice thing is usually these passwords, these authentication tokens are well established, you with your bank, and it's not like with 3D Secure where suddenly supposed to on some very different website authenticate yourself. And it's once when you withdraw money, so pretty much like when you go to an ATM to withdraw cash. Then when you want to spend money, there's also two-factor authentication implemented, which is you have to own your notebook, that's a physical token, and you have to be able to log into your notebook or your mobile device. So that's your normal username and password that you use for accessing your computer. Okay. And once you have access to your web browser, that's it. You don't need any usernames or passwords anymore. You pay with one click because you own your computer and thereby you own your cash, just like you own your physical wallet.
Yes, but what if somebody compromises my computer?
If somebody compromises your computer, he can steal the money that's in your wallet. As in the amount that you choose to withdraw from your bank account to your wallet, your loss is bounded by that.
Oh, you put it into a wallet.
It's an electronic wallet, yes.
Yes.
And
okay.
So you would, but unlike in Bitcoin, you don't have all of your wealth in your wallet.
Yeah.
You can leave your, you know, hundreds of thousands of euros in your bank account and you withdraw 10 euros.
And right? You have that local.
And then that's the maximum loss you can entertain if your computer is compromised at that time. The nice thing is you will learn something, namely that you've been compromised, and usually for most of us, the amount we would withdraw for daily transactions is going to be in a range where we can say if our computer is compromised and I learn that I've been so really badly hacked and my hard drive might be encrypted next, maybe worth that loss.
Yeah. Very good. Excellent. Where can I find more information about your project?
You can find more information on Thaler.net.
Yeah. And that's it.
Cool. It's easy as that, yes.
Excellent. Thank you very much for taking the time for the interview.
You're welcome.
And I'm talking to
Hernani Marquez. I am a council member of the PEP Foundation, which holds the rights to the core code of PEP, that is the engine written in C for portability reasons, and lots of adapters for Java, JavaScript, whatever.
But what is PEP?
PEP is pretty easy privacy with an emphasis on the E, so we write it always in big letters or with the equivalent symbols. And it is about, in the first place now, to make mail encryption really easy for all users. So it's you should get a zero-touch experience when using PEP software. That means you just install it, keys are automatically generated, the public key is sent as attachment to the other peers, and they can either manually import it, or if they have PEP, it will be imported automatically, and as of then, both can communicate already in a secure way. That means as secure as OpenPGP is, and we believe it is quite secure still. So when this is done, you have we have a traffic light semantics. We show to the user a color, it's a privacy status we call it. And if there's no color, it's an unencrypted email, or there's some kind of unreliable communication, also commercial SMIME with commercial CAs we consider as not very trustworthy, so we show it gray. But if you have PGP, it is yellow, and then you can make one single step which the user has to do. It is to compare your trustwords. What are trustwords? Trustwords are the PGP fingerprints or other fingerprints in other encryption standards, which are mapped into natural language words like English, German, French, whatever. We will also put this list, of course, online, so everyone which implements PEP can use the same list. So. And then you have words to compare that you can do in place if you meet someone, or by a side channel like telephone. And then in your privacy status, when you have done that, and when you have accepted that the communication is trustworthy, the privacy status turns green. And it also reads, if you are colorblind, you can also read trusted and secure. Trusted because you verified it, and secure because it's still, let's say, OpenPGP involved.
Okay.
And we also, okay.
One step back here. So we're talking about email only, or?
No, we start with email, but it's just the beginning, not the end. So we start there where we have, in our opinion, the biggest issue. We have lots of unencrypted emails going around. I mean, Hillary Clinton can even create a song about it, I think, after she lost candidacy because of such things, perhaps. So, but also for normal users, you have your flight data being sent around, you have your bank data, your medical data. That's really a big problem. And email, if you like it or not, it is still the biggest identity system we have, used for Twitter, for Facebook, for everything, to recover your passports and stuff like that. So we want to protect this channel first. When we are done with that, that means when we have an iOS app, an Android app, when we have Outlook, when we have integrated into Enigmail, and finally Enigmail and PEP into Thunderbird and everything like that, for every system and platform, what concerns the order, we take the ones with the biggest market share. That's why we start with Outlook in Enigmail. When we are done with that, we'll add further transports like XMPP, OTR, or Omino, which is quite new. We can also add Signal. We can even try to interface with the official Signal systems, and the user will have a unified inbox in the end in his PEP app, showing all the contacts, and the PEP engine, the core part of the project, will always choose the most posted part for the PEP, for the surveiller, or the most secure for the user.
Okay.
So we also call it the most closed filter.
Okay.
From the perspective of the surveillance guys.
Okay. Just before we lose everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
So from an email point of view, you're still using PGP.
Yes.
Or GPT.
Yes. We use GNUPG for almost all platforms, excluding iOS, where we have to use NetPGP. That's an implementation of the OpenPGP standard done by the NetBSD project, which is not actively maintained anymore.
Okay.
That's just for licensing reasons. If you would find an agreement with GNUPG, we could probably multi-license the GNUPG code in a way that you can also ship it inside the iOS app or together with the iOS app, and then users can use GNUPG with all the advanced features with GNUPG has.
Okay, so I already use GPT.
Mm-hmm.
What are the advantages of using Pep on top of that?
The advantage is, the Pep project is not for power users specifically, it is for normal people.
Well, I'm normal as well.
Okay, but if you use PGP, you are normal plus, kind of.
Yeah.
So
I don't want to be normal.
The point is I cannot help.
I want to be normal.
Okay. The story behind Pep is when the Snowden revelations came about in Switzerland, we had lots of inquiries to the CCC Switzerland, and specifically in Zurich, how can we protect ourselves from this mass surveillance stuff? And then we organized lots of crypto parties. And we learned from this, what we learned from these crypto parties is that people in the end are not really able to use it in daily communications.
Yeah.
So we just said, okay, what are we teaching these people? We are telling them, they should create a private key, they should do this and that, and they should look it up at the key server, whatever. And we just said, okay, let's just write this down as a protocol and turn it into code. So people will just have automatic mail encryption being done for them. So if you install Enigmail Pep or Enigmail 2.0 in the future, for each mail account you have, Pep will automatically create an RSA 4096 key pair, and then the public keys are attached to every email, and if the other peer, your communication partner also has Pep, it will be automatically imported, and then you can start to encrypt.
So
then you can even verify if you have fears because you are a journalist of man-in-the-middle attacks, you can start, you can even verify and turn your channel green. And from a technical point of view, that's perfectly secure. So there's no much criticism you can against this, because it's just, we also have a code update on our engine, so that everyone can have some trust that we are doing the right things, we are using technology correctly, we are not doing old crypto, we are just using what's already available. Yes, so we are not a crypto project, we are a more like a usability project using existing crypto and also doing political work and community work. So we are active on several fronts.
Super. Now, what happens if I give this to my medical partner and they decide to, they use it and the keys are generated and their computer crashes and dies?
Yes, that's a good point. We also thought a lot about it. We have a key synchronization protocol at Pep. It's not cloud-based or platform-centric like there are other projects also in the which provide easy to use mail encryption, but as a platform. So Pep is on a platform. So what we do is, if you have an iPhone and let's say a Thunderbird installation, for both installations fully independent of each other without communication between them, before that, key material is created on both sides. The oldest key is assumed to be the one you want to have as a blue key. Because you encrypt already since 3 years and all people know your key, so you want to stick that key, and now you bought the iPhone, you installed the Pep for iOS, and the new key pair is created.
How does that for iOS know that I am whatsoever?
Yes, the common denominator is that you need a common mail address, so you use the same mail address on both devices.
Yeah.
Usually that's also a requirement for companies or for regular users.
Okay.
They want to be able to read their messages across devices.
I could make an email address on my iOS with your email address.
Yeah, but you have to be able to receive this mail. you have to hack my email account or my mail server to create receive mails
from you. So there is a mail sent through your email account to verify this.
Yes. So basically, you just configure the same email address on both devices.
Yeah.
Both generate keys independently of each other, and then one of the both devices start to send discovery messages to. What does it mean? That means you just send technical emails. I mean, technically, it's just an email, but to oneself. And the other device sees this email and reacts to it and says, yeah, I'm here. And then you can say, yeah, okay, you are here. Do you want to become a device group with me? And then you can say yes. And what you do to confirm this, you compare again your trust words. Okay? We just display common trust words. So on both displays, the same words are visible. These are combined fingerprints. And then you just accept. The channel turns on both devices green. And then your private key material is fully transmitted in all directions, for these two devices. And then you can read your old and your new emails, regardless whoever received them before and stuff like that. So that's the way we have. And if you lose a device, you can say device lost. And you can even say, I want to recreate all of my key material because my device were hacked or something. And that's the way we go here. So, of course, if you have an attacker attacking your iPhone, they can read all your past communications. But that's a problem with OpenPGP in general because it's not formal secrecy being done. For OTR and Omemo and stuff, there are other solutions. But you see, you can at least still read your emails. If you have at least two devices, we will probably also add some backup feature for users with just one device, but we are not yet sure how to do that in a user-friendly way. That's an issue because there's another project called AutoCrypt. They proposed to just write your private key as soon as it's generated to your own mail address again, and just let it encrypted there with a passphrase, which is very long.
Yeah.
But I am not very confident personally that people are able to re-enter passphrase which is 20 digits or longer, or 20 chars or whatever. So because you need some entropy for this physical. Otherwise, if NSA hacks your mail server or just gets it, they can probably encrypt the private key and then use it against you. So if you have two devices, you should be fine. You have, of course, a problem if everything is burned. Everything is burned, and you lose everything. Then you have a real issue. But I think then you have also bigger problems.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. Yeah.
So this key synchronization thing is really one of our big differentiators to other projects because there is no cloud in between. And then you can also think a little bit further. Of course, you will do it. You will also be able to share your contact data and your events, calendar data. Across the devices in a way without any cloud in between, so fully peer-to-peer. As you can send around your private keys to your mail address, you can also send your calendar data and your event data there are standards for that, these iThings or whatever, and then you can just import it and then it is displayed in your mail user agent like always, but on the other device too.
Yeah.
And we use, to avoid race conditions, we use SQL transactions. So on each PEP device, you have an SQLite database.
Yeah.
By the way, all the trust stuff that you trust, the communication partner and stuff, is not saved in the key ring of GNU-PG. It is saved separately in this database. So you can sync even the trust separately from GNU-PG.
And is that not a vulnerability that access to these ways?
It's locally saved. I mean, if your device is hacked, you are lost anyways because your private key is lost. And so it's just here. It's just a project.
You're running on a laptop anyway.
Yeah. In my case, yes. But it's could also send me a Trojan horse and I could install
exactly.
It. I mean, we are not proof against everything. PEP is about ending mass surveillance.
Yeah.
If you have specifically targeted surveillance like NSA does with tailored access operations, then you have a problem, of course. But that's very costly, and I don't think they are able to afford this for the whole planet.
So for in jurisdictions, for example, like in the UK, where the license is charged on
us,
we're going to implement this easy on this PC, all the family, and then it will just work.
It will just work. If I give this to my mother, she has no idea of computers, but she can barely use email and stuff like that. So she would be able to encrypt writing emails to me, which are perfectly fine encrypted with NuPG, without her touching everything.
And there's no passwords to be entered?
No, that's also a thing we decided. We won't use passphrases by default. But we support them. So if someone wants to enter a postphrase for a specific time frame, 5 minutes, an hour, something like that, it's fine with us. But we won't impose that on the users. We want to have an experience like Signal or WhatsApp in that regard. Imagine WhatsApp introducing postphrase by default. I think they would lose 99% of their user base immediately. So you cannot do that because we are a usability project. But we support it still. I mean, that's not a point. If you want to have that, it's fine. Even the trust channel, the green channel thing with verification of your identity, of your communication partner, that's just nice to have, in my opinion, because I would be already fine if I would receive more encrypted emails specifically from companies, like flight companies, like insurances. If it's not green, if it's perfectly encrypted, like grace not good, that would be like plain text, but if it's yellow, that means perfectly encrypted, it's already fine. There might still be a middle attack going on in the middle, but that would be the price for it. And then you can probably find different ways with companies to put your channel green, probably they create some employee to do such stuff. No idea. But there will be solutions, I'm quite sure.
So basically, once you start installing this, as you go out and you update your Kafka's PC, yes, and you add this, then transparently in the background, yes, it just starts happening.
Yes, yes. There's also the principle that we don't hassle users. That means if the key generation process at the very first start is not yet finished, you can already start to write emails which are shown with privacy status unencrypted, unsecure is the term, because colorblind people, we need also a word.
Yeah. Can you hold that one?
Yes, yeah, you can just, I mean, we don't want users not to be able to communicate. Communication is priority first. And then it's privacy and security.
You're essentially designing a secure virus, really.
Virus
would be a nice term.
Yeah, well, we have an approach for that. The PEP Foundation will make sure that every project which wants to use the PEP trademark, which is pretty easy, privacy and the logo and stuff like that, they will have to have a code audit done on every release. So companies will be able to afford this, I'm sure. For community projects, we'll organize funding for them.
Okay.
So the code audit must be complete. That means technically complete, really with details as far as possible, because in closed source software it might be a problem like WhatsApp. But for open source projects, it must really be complete and carried out by an independent third party which is specialized on code audits and without ties to secret services and military.
For as much as you can tell.
So, firms which have these principles are very welcome to be listed at PEP Foundation site as trustworthy companies, but you will also meet them in person first, because you really want to know that they don't oversee bugs or somehow propose to create some sneaky backdoors kind of things. So, if you say with PEP you install a virus, I think it could become complicated.
No, well, I'm actually more acting like it's a...
It's viral.
Becomes viral.
Yeah, I mean, we have really the idea that we end mass surveillance here now. I mean, yeah. In the next 1 or 2 years, we'll be available on all platforms. There's also PEP Security, a commercial entity that we have a Red Hat-like business model. So they will try to sell our open source software to companies with service contracts. And we expect lots of emails to be encrypted with PEP.
Yeah.
In the future, with
it would be great if it was a drop-down list, your tick box beside your email address, tick for PEP encrypted.
Yes, yeah.
That would be the goal.
Yeah, and in the end, we'll have lots of ciphertext around, and these programs from the NSA, like XKeyscore, will be even more worthless than now, we hope.
Okay.
And that's just the beginning, as I said in the beginning of this interview. We will also activate with PEP 2.0, we'll activate GNUnet. GNUnet is an official GNU project, which provides a peer-to-peer framework for secure end-to-end encrypted communications. You have first you have encryption and encryption on device level. So you have a public and private key for your device, and then you have also private and public key for your identity. It's called, I think, in SecureShare, it's a project of GNUNet. It's called Ego. So that's yourself, and you can have different egos. You can have your real name, then some whistleblower name you can take, then some journalist name, some company name. So you can choose different identities, and then you have so that means you have inside the device encrypted thing, you have the user encrypted thing too, and the metadata will be protected by default. So that means you won't see anything anymore. You just see, okay, someone connected to GNUNet, like with Tor, but you don't really see what this person is doing inside the GNUNet.
Yeah.
And we want to deploy the GNUNet on a worldwide scale, really in extreme numbers.
Just make it become ubiquitous.
Yes, widespread. Yes, yes, yeah. Of course. So what the surveillance guys are doing is nice for them. What we are doing is not so nice for them, and we just do a counter project here. Yeah. Nothing less than that. And we are very confident that we will achieve the goals.
Excellent. What's coming up next? Well, you've already discussed that. Have we missed anything?
No. I think it's most important things that I've said.
How can I install it? Where can I get it from?
Yes. At the moment, there is PEP for Outlook. That you can get. There is a shop on the commercial side. You can also build it yourself, but the company is not interested in providing it fully for free, so they sell it.
Yeah.
But that's just for Outlook. For Android, you have a version. You can just enter Pretty Easy Privacy in Google Play Store. Then you can get a PEP for Android for free. And there's also Afterit version for people which don't like Google Play. For iOS, there will be, of course, a version in the App Store.
Yeah.
We will also provide instructions for jailbreaking to build it yourself and install it yourself. At the foundation side, the company side has no interest in that, of course.
Obviously, yeah.
Because commercial interests. And for Enigmail, you can just, in the future, you'll just be able to install the add-on through your package system, or in Windows, you just add it. And then the software which is needed, the PEP software, is downloaded automatically without user interaction, like it is done already now for Windows, where also GPG for Win is installed automatically, silently in the background. So the same thing will happen for PEP, but we will go even a step further with Enigmail. We'll put the whole thing together, Enigmail 2.0 or Enigmail PEP. We'll just take it and put it into Thunderbird. So we have a user base of 40 million users there. More or less, I don't know if the figures are still correct, but it's in that direction, which will be able to encrypt by default automatically without interaction.
As a base install of Thunderbird?
Yes.
Absolutely excellent.
Yes.
That is fantastic.
And then if you take this together with Outlook and Android and iOS, you will have lots of more ciphertext in the very near future.
Yeah.
We are really working hard, even day and night, some of us, to just achieve these goals still this year. In Switzerland, we have even good reasons for that, because we also introduced mass surveillance. We'll be put in place by September 1st. There's a secret service law where they can tap fiber cables and everything. And there's also a law for interception law, where you can install Trojan horses, retain data for 6 months on all channels, not just service providers, also providers like Threema, ProtonMail. They want everything. It's really the big coup there. And the people were not very active, so it was a little bit difficult to stop these laws. For the secret service law, we even have the referendum, but it failed, with more than 60% of the people saying yes to the secret service law because of the terrorism happening around Switzerland. So we have a direct democracy, but that's no guarantee we mess around with our basic rights. So, yep. So we also have, because we are based in Switzerland, we also have a nice local context to put this stuff out. But of course, the project is worldwide.
Yeah, very good. Excellent interview. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah.
Hi everybody, I'm at the FreeBSD Foundation booth and I'm talking to
Benedikt Reuschling.
I just had to put the number there or I wouldn't be able to remember when I'm editing the shows, exactly. So, what is FreeBSD for those who don't know?
Well, FreeBSD is an operating system for regular computer users. So we're actually a quite old system. We're stemming from the University of California at Berkeley. That was developed in the 1970s. And it evolved since then. It became an open source project in the 90s, and we've been an open source project ever since.
And it's released under a BSD license, I'm guessing?
That's the GPL-free operating system. We have our own license with only three clauses in them. And that actually draws a lot of people to our project because some companies are reluctant to use the GPL, and the BSD license is more integrating those commercial components for them. So that's a better alternative for them.
So what's been happening in the last year with FreeBSD?
Oh, we did a lot of good. We have a big release. We had a big release coming out. It's FreeBSD 11. It features a lot of new stuff like embedded work, new Wi-Fi drivers. We have our own hypervisor now called Beehive, the BSD hypervisor. And we're doing a lot of work behind the scenes to exchange our build toolchain. So for a lot of time, we had the GNU compiler collection. But now we have the Clang LLVM bootstrap toolchain, so we can build the not only the kernel, but also all the userland tools with it. So FreeBSD is a complete operating system. We're not only providing a kernel, but we're also building the userland tools around it, all the libraries, all the shared utilities that you are using. And building that as one big package is actually a good system to have because it's all produced by one vendor.
And are you reliant on a lot of the GPL stuff, or are you becoming less reliant on GPL stuff? Or
yes, that's our overall goal, to have BSD licensed tools and don't rely on external compiler tools just to build the operating system.
And what have you planned going forward this year?
This year we're trying to get not only involved in other. So we're not going to BSD conferences only with the foundation, but we're also trying to be at other conferences where we aren't featured that much. And development-wise, we're trying to evolve our current system into adding more features, like getting more support for virtualization options, and we also want to include more wireless drivers and graphics, like the KMS graphics drivers. That's a big feature because a lot of people are asking for BSD on the desktop. There are distributions of FreeBSD on the desktop called TrueOS, but they also need the graphics support to run the latest stuff. We're also having a project to integrate Wayland. We have an initial version in the system now, and we hope to have that as an alternative to the rather old X11.
A lot of stuff going on. So, anything else that we missed or we should have covered?
BSD is a very nice community. We have a very good documentation. We have a complete handbook on our website. And if you want to go to a BSD conference, I encourage you to do that. So we have three major conferences. First one is Asia BSDCon in March. The biggest one in North America is BSDCon in, when's it, in June?
June.
And the EuroBSDCon, that's a traveling circus. It's a different country each year. And this year we're going to be in Paris. So if you want to get involved or look at what the BSDs are doing, go to one of those conferences.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Illuminos booth, and I'm talking to
Hans Rosenfeld.
And can you tell me what the project is?
So Illuminos is an operating system core based on OpenSolaris, which is developed independently of Oracle, who have stopped that a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And we are building the system in collaboration with a couple of companies that use it for their products. And there's also a lot of community users. And they usually take the core that we provide, which is the kernel libraries, userland utilities, daemons, whatever makes a Solaris system, and put whatever else you need to make it a complete function and OS distribution, and tailor that to their specific needs.
During the first .com boom, Solaris was powering a lot of that. Is this still the case today, that it's Illuminos has taken over that role and still as relevant today as it was in the past?
Well, Illuminos is certainly not as relevant as Solaris used to be. It's a very small community, but it's making progress. It's getting more importance. There are more companies using it. And I recently learned it's used in cloud computing, even in Germany, where I'm from.
Yeah.
And a company named Giant is using it in cloud computing. They recently got bought by Samsung. They're building a cloud for them based on that technology. There's an Accenture Rector, T-Gile, who builds storage systems based on Illumos.
Okay.
So.
And what has there been any major milestones this year?
Major milestones this year. So we had greatly improved NVMe support, which was actually added in 2015 already. We improved that last year greatly. We recently gained USB 3 support, which has been quite a problem for a while because the company developers didn't really consider that important, but that has changed now. And the distributions have made progress on themselves. Open Indiana is one of the distributions doing a desktop systems. They are currently modernizing the software that they ship for desktop purposes. They've got a Mate desktop and brand new Firefox and all that kind of stuff.
So you're you will be the equivalent to Linux of the distribution world. You would be the top level.
Yeah. So except that the difference is Linux just a kernel. We are kernel libraries. Use it on whatever you need. But pretty much the core of what used to be Solaris.
Okay.
And what's happening this year? What are the plans going forward?
A lot of stuff.
I don't know what those different companies plan, actually.
Yeah.
There's obviously going to be improvements in terms of virtualization and cloud computing support coming from Giant.
Yeah.
The USB support, USB 3 support is going to be improved greatly. I'm personally working on improving NVMe support, which is quite a big deal right now. Not sure what other companies plan, really.
Yeah.
So you basically develop whatever, you accept whatever comes
in. There's no strong leadership or anything, that's a direction. Yeah, it's just a loose collaboration.
Whatever the community wants, the community gets.
Exactly.
And has it been a bit of a success, do you think? Are you getting more developers?
Slowly, but steadily, yes. Well, we've been there 7 years, we've been a small community then, we're still a small community, but we're slowly growing, very slowly.
Excellent. And where can I go to get more information?
There's obviously illumos.org.
Yeah.
There's IRC channel, Illumos on Freenode. There's a couple of IRC channels and websites dedicated to the different distributions, modos.org, openindiana.org.
And if I go to your website, I'll get links to the distributions?
Yeah, there are links on it. There's a wiki and there are links on it.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi everybody, this is Ken. I'm at the K1A9 OpenSUSE booth and I'm talking to
Douglas DeMaio.
Hi, Douglas. What has you here at FOSDEM?
Well, so we come here every year to basically, you know, show our support for FOSS and also have an appearance and talk about the things that we have new that are coming out.
So what is OpenSUSE for people who don't know?
Well, OpenSUSE is the oldest Linux distribution. And basically we have two distributions. We have a rolling release called Tumbleweed. And we have what is called Leap, OpenSUSE Leap, and that's sort of like the traditional OpenSUSE that most people are familiar with.
Yep.
And the current one we have out right now is 42.2. And that came out in November. And just recently we got the cloud images up for EC2 and also Google's cloud and a bunch of others. So we have a lot of cloud images out that people can use for whatever purposes they have.
And you're based here in Germany, are you?
The project's all over the world, but most of the people that are coming here to FOSDEM are coming from Germany, but we have a large presence in Europe, America, South America, Asia. So we'll have some people come here to FOSDEM from those different locations, but most people are coming from Germany.
Now, you said OpenSUSE was an oldest distribution. Surely Debian and Slackware would beat you to that.
Exactly. But when we're talking about the bigger ones, yes.
Okay, fighting words for the Debian team later on when I interview them. So tell me, any new plans for what's going to be happening this year with the OpenSUSE?
Well, right now we're working on 42.3 as well as 43, kind of happening at the same time. We do have some a few new things coming out. Of course, we have different projects within the OpenSUSE project. If you're
the Open Build Service is going to be here as well.
The Open Build Service, OpenQA, yeah. if you're familiar with that.
I'll be interviewing them separately, but yep.
Okay. And then, of course, we have Portis as well and Machinery. Those are two other projects that you might be
familiar with. Give us the lowdown on those.
So Portis is Portis is a way of managing your container images, right?
Yeah.
So I can't really talk specifically about it because I'm the PR guy. I know a little bit. I know a little bit about it, right? So that's a project that started about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And you know, we're just trying to push that information out there so people can try it, see what they think about it. And then, of course, Machinery is sort of a project that we've been working on about the same amount of time. And this allows you to see what's on your system. You could also use it on other distributions to kind of see what's on your system. It's really sort of a combination of tools into one big tool.
Okay, very good. And so do you get a lot out of FOSDEM every year, or what is the goal? Why even bother coming?
Well, you know, this is really about meeting people within the community and then of course rekindling old friendships. So I mean, there's a lot of people. I've only been here 2 years, you know, and of course many other people that come from OpenSUSE have been coming here for years. Yeah, for years. And of course it's always nice to meet up with them. And of course you have new people coming that are unfamiliar with the different projects that are here. And you know, that's kind of why we're here, right? We're here to bring people into the FOSS world and the open source world and
ideally the OpenSUSE part of the
that would be ideal. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything else that I missed or wanted?
Well, so with Tumbleweed, you know, if you're familiar with that, that's our rolling release, and the numbers have grown on that. There are a lot of users, a lot of people that are using it, and if you're familiar with Arch Linux, you know, it's sort of basis, exactly. But you know, of course, we compile that. So when you get daily snapshots, and it's pretty much daily snapshots. I mean, this past I just wrote a story yesterday, and in the past 8 days, we had 7 snapshots. We got of course, it's system D. 232 has been out for a bit, but you know, we got that into the rolling release, and then we were the first basically to get other than probably Neon, get KDE 5.9 in, and that was basically the same day.
I use KDE, and I have this problem to do with the formatting of date from the ISO 8601 days, specifically year dash dash month dash dash day. Every time I come to FOSDEM, people tell me that bug is fixed, but it's not fixed. It's an underlying bug in the Qt toolkit.
Okay.
How can I get this fixed? Who do I need to buy beer for? Irish whiskey? I don't care. Cup of nice tea, whatever it takes.
There's a guy that's gonna be here named I always say Alex, but I know it's different. He's from Spain. Yeah. Go talk to him, and he will probably help you out. Or you could probably talk to Harold Sitter. He's working with KDE Neon with Jonathan Riddell. Yeah. And so I'd go buy beer for them, and they could
probably. I've already tried. It doesn't work.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time, and have a great show.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm at the CentOS booth, and I'm talking to
Fabian Aretin.
What is CentOS?
Okay, CentOS is, of course, a Linux distribution, free to use from the community, built by the community, but it's built from Red Hat Enterprise Linux sources, meaning that we just take the Red Hat Enterprise Linux sources, RPM, we just recompile it, we just sometimes modify or add component that the company is interested in, and then we distribute that to people so that they can consume directly.
So this is a Red Hat sponsored project, but not a Red Hat project?
It is a Red Hat sponsored project, so we have resources. I'm a Red Hat employee myself, and we are other colleagues who are working on that. But we are working, CentOS is not only the rebuild of distribution these days, it's also a platform for other projects to contribute and work on. So for example, we have worked a lot with people having interested in a cloud solution like AirDio for OpenStack, storage solution like Glister of Ceph, and all those kind of other projects that they are interested in. So we have specific big build for them.
Okay, how does it differ for something like Fedora, which is also a Red Hat project?
So that's Fedora is considered the upstream of what RHEL will become in the next years. So RHEL is basically a snapshot and supported version of Fedora point in time. We are downstream of RHEL, but still some other project would like to have a stable platform that they want to build on top and not care about the platform itself. So CentOS is perfect for them because they just don't care about the platform. They just built on top and they just can have community members doing their testing on that platform and not care about the platform anymore.
How does that, if I had a choice of between CoreOS and Red Hat Enterprise Linux and Oracle Unbreakable Linux, which one should I pick?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that would be objective, but I would say of course CentOS, but CentOS is not only about the bits and bytes of a distribution, but also about the community and the spirit around the community. So that's what we have built in the last 10 years, more than 10 years for the CentOS. I think the strongest point of CentOS is the community, and the C in CentOS is also community.
What's the E?
Sorry?
What's the E then?
Well, enterprise operating system. So it's a community enterprise operating system.
Ah, very good. Did not know that. You learn something new every day. But is CentOS not just a gateway drug? It's like a subpar product that will force people to get support from Red Hat for enterprise Linux.
What do you mean by that? Can you clarify?
I mean that, here you can use this free thing, but when the merit hits the fan, then you're going to have to upgrade and actually run real Red Hat Enterprise.
It turns into a sales discussion here, but yeah. I would say that it depends on your needs, right? So, depending on your needs, you probably need or not a company you want to knock at the door if there is a problem, of course.
And if you don't, you use CentOS.
Exactly.
So tell me, what have been the major achievements here in the last year?
So in the last year, because we had more time to work, because we were doing that on our free time before, and now some of us have the chance to work on that on a daily basis, we have achieved a lot. And before, it was just a distribution. And those days, we were also... We built some bridges with other projects, meaning that we are doing a lot of integration testing with all the projects, like CI. We achieve a lot at the CI and CD platform, like CI.CentOS.org, which we built. And a lot of the projects are just testing their bits before it's released with us. So the whole thing is now that we have built confidence with the user, because it's not just something that we just built when we had spare time, but so a professional aspect on top.
It is quite used there in the old cloud, I must say.
Yeah. And coming up next year, what's the plan?
So the plan is also to expand the CI environment in collaboration with other projects. Container is a thing. Yes. So we are at the moment working on something that would let other people to build a kind of pipeline to build a container and tests, validate it and distribute it through registry.ci, registry.centos.org as well, so that they could automatically have pre-built application, validate it, test it on CentOS directly.
Yeah. Oh, very good. And are you going to be at other shows or what's the focus?
Depending on the event, some people will like to obviously attend and show CentOS, yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm at the Fedora booth. Very, very cold Fedora booth here. They've been stuck at the door. I don't think that's got its advantages and disadvantages. But I'm talking to?
I'm Justin Flory. I'm a contributor for about a year and a half now.
Okay. What is Fedora?
Fedora is a free and open source Linux operating system that's, I think, can be pretty accurately described in our four foundations: freedom, friends, features first. So Fedora has a very strong commitment to free and open source software, and that all of the software that we do have available by default in our repositories is open source. We don't have proprietary or third-party programs that are proprietary in the distribution by default, because we're very committed to trying to find the best open source solution for our users. Features and first from a development side, I think, is also important, because Fedora is very committed to trying to champion new open source tech and trying to do it in a way that's stable and is also trying to push forward and try out these new things for everyone else in the Linux community as well. And lastly, I think Friend is important too, because it's a community that spans the entire world from 6 out of 7 continents. So maybe 7, I don't know. But it's a very large community of people working on a mixed variety of different parts of the project. So I think you can really sum up Fedora through our 4 foundations.
Okay, very good. And what has been happening in the Fedora community projects in the last year?
So one of the biggest things that just actually recently happened was the Fedora Cloud Edition, which was one of the 3 primary offerings of Fedora, along with the workstation and the server. We moved the cloud edition away as a primary one, and instead we're now offering the Fedora Atomic Host, which is really exciting for people who are looking at building new cloud infrastructure or trying to experiment with new things along those lines. If you're doing things with Kubernetes or OpenShift, Fedora Atomic would kind of be your base that you're putting in there. And it right now, there's kind of like a short term, like what can it do now, and then a long term, what do we want it to be? Short term, it's kind of, if you're familiar with the Fedora development model, it's kind of like Fedora Rawhide, in that it's the latest and very cutting edge of Fedora, but it's very easy for you to roll back if something goes wrong. Whereas if it was in Rawhide proper, like, okay, what went wrong? I need to downgrade it, I need to fix my kernel or do whatever. With Atomic, you can just roll back your entire system state to exactly where it was before. So.
And does that also apply to applications that we're running? Does that apply to my own applications that we're running?
So long term, so right now it's definitely something that's very new, and it's shaping and, or it's in the process of shaping into something that will be a long term, or that will end up being something that will be useful for workstation and server. So the idea is that you could be, let's say that you're doing something with, you upgrade your networking, network manager on your laptop, and then, your driver's broke or something where you don't have wireless connectivity. So it's like, what are you going to do? Because you can't look up troubleshooting or how to fix it. So the idea is that you would have an atomic-like workstation, so you can just roll your entire system state back to the way it was before, and you can fix whatever the problem was or go deeper that way. And the same thing for the server side too. And that's kind of where we want it to go long term. Short term right now, there's a few people who are using it as their daily driver desktop, but it's still kind of a wild ride from what I'm taking, because it's a 2-week release cycle, so it moves very quickly. But the idea is that even though it's moving so fast, because of the design where you can roll back your system state if you need to, it's supposed to be even more stable than like the Rawhide offering would be. So I really think the next year or next 2 years for the Atomic Host will be very exciting for Fedora. And it's definitely something that a lot of people in our community are very excited and passionate about. And we're also working closely with the CentOS community on that as well, as far as I'm aware. That's something that recently changed, and some of the bigger things, one of the new campaigns that we launched for this past year was Fedora Loves Python, and we have a few stickers around the booth for that. But the idea is that we're trying to reach out to the people who are using Fedora, instead of trying to be, Fedora is great for everyone, which I would say it is, but the idea that we're trying to get to is that we're trying to target communities of developers that are working with a specific set of software that we feel that Fedora has a very strong offering on. And for us, Python is everywhere in Fedora, within not only within the distribution, but our community as well. A lot of the infrastructure and applications that we're building in Fedora are heavily based in Python. So it's very easy for us to kind of explain and show all the amazing ways that you can do things with Python and Fedora. There's actually a site, fedoraloves.python.org. I'm not 100% sure on that. There's actually a website that really goes into this and shows all the specific things about why you'd want to use Python as a Fedora developer, why Python is great, and the advantages that it would provide to you versus another distribution. But that's something that's really cool too, that we've been doing for, I guess, probably the past 8 months. And if you end up catching us at an event, I know in North America or Europe, you'll probably be able to find some of the Fedora Loves Python stickers floating around too.
Okay, cool. Are you going to many more festivals or more events during the year?
As far as I know right now, there's a few things that we have lined up for the next few months. I know PyCon Slovakia, we should have a presence there. The next major conference I can think of in the Europe region will be OSCAL, which is Open Source Conference Albania. This is usually the heaviest part of the
conference. We're worldwide, so.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I'm not as sure for Latin America and in Asia. In North America, I think the next thing that we have coming up is the Southeast Linux Fest, which will be in, I think, May or June. And we always have an annual presence there. And then I think there's one more event in the next few months in North America too, but I'm not a little unsure on the specifics.
That'd be on fedora.org, I guess.
Yeah, get Fedora. We'll be sure to be promoting it on the Fedora magazine. Is the great place to look for anything that's coming up in the Fedora community, as well as actually finding great guides about how to get the most out of Fedora. So I would definitely recommend the Fedora magazine as a great way to keep in touch with everything that's happening in the Fedora community, and also to find out maybe ways you can better utilize or use Fedora in your own system.
Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.